Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
I was delayed coming here because I accidentally pressed the wrong button on my keyboard, and it locked my Mac Studio. I could still hear you.
Right, sure.
But it was locked, and I had to do some Touch ID to log back in and unlock it. The keyboard under the desk, by the way. That's
an important detail.
And you can't see the keys because there's just a keyboard. Yeah, so I'm doing the Mike Hurley thing where I have Velcroed a Touch ID, Apple Touch ID keyboard under my desk because I want Touch ID and I don't want to use Apple's keyboard.
Yep.
And there is that guy who like cut it up and so that all that is left is a button, which I kind of like that idea. But I just have the whole keyboard under there. But that the side effect is sometimes my hand reaches under there and presses a different button or presses that button all the way and it locks. Sometimes I mistype things because I'm like, oh, whoa, I typed something from that keyboard that's under there. It's invisible otherwise, though, which is awesome. I just, you know, I would have bought a standalone Touch ID device from Apple if they would have.
If they made it. But they don't. They don't. Yep.
They don't. And I don't want to use their keyboard. I mean, their keyboard is fine and all, but like I have a fancy, nice mechanical keyboard. That's my keyboard. So this other thing is just a Touch ID receptacle Velcroed under my desk off to the right where I can reach my finger from time to time. I should probably like download Carabiner Elements or something and just literally lock out every other key on that keyboard. So it's completely, you know, because I could theoretically type an article, but I would be reaching under my desk typing sideways because it's long ways. Because I want to reduce the amount of threat surface at the front of the desk that are keys that I could type.
Sure. Yeah. Makes sense. I think you've stumbled upon a new ergonomic solution, right? You've seen remember those old split keyboards where they had like two separate sides?
Oh, you're not
you
gonna
just
have...
put them under the desk.
Under the desk, like, yeah. Also, I thought you were going to say that it's a new method for being a mentalist or magician, where it's like, how is he even typing? And the answer is the keyboard is under the
desk.
Amazing. That's the, for people who don't know, the baseball, baseball now allows catchers and pitchers to communicate rather than using laborious hand signs about what pitch is going to be thrown with a little push button thing. That goes to a little kind of headpiece that you wear inside your baseball hat. And this technology was imported from a company that makes this equipment and they don't like to talk about it a lot for understandable reasons. It's for mentalists and magicians. And this is how, when you're like, how does he do it? How does he know? The answer is he's got a thing in his hat. Or on his head or in his ear or wherever it is. And then there's somebody out there relaying messages to him secretly.
That's the high-tech version. I remember
they don't want to talk about
the low-tech versions. But
they're shining a light somewhere. Or there's
there's words, keywords from the assistant who sets things up. Back in the old days, right? Like in the 1900s, before they had all this technology, there would be, I studied a lot of like magic stuff when I was a kid because I was into that.
You're a really cool kid.
I was a really cool kid with lots of friends.
That explains how you and Lex are such good friends.
That's right. He's way better than I am. I was just interested in the theory. I was never great at the practice of it. But like they would have like mentalists use a certain like, just words in the way that their assistants would relay things. You know, they might use, oh, this is an answer of which you will be interested or something like that. They would phrase things in certain ways and it would indicate, you know, certain key ideas to convey.
They can kind of riff on that.
They do the cold reads and stuff
exactly.
like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I hate to break it to people, but now they use technology and now baseball is using that technology.
Sacred.
The Athletic did a great story about it where they talk about the company that makes it. And they're like, we don't really like to talk about this, but we saw a business opportunity for baseball. And it's very clever, but it is also kind of funny because the idea there was surreptitious communication.
Jason, I'll tell you, I went to a baseball game the other night.
Ah, the Boston Red Sox?
The Boston Red Sox. It was interesting. A friend had some tickets and could not, I guess it was his family, who I realized, as he was telling us, are very big sports fans, as he detailed how they have tickets to literally all of the major sporting teams. And they could not go on Wednesday night because there was also a Celtics playoff game. They decided rightfully to take those tickets. So he offered them to my wife and I, and we went and joined him. And the seat, it was kind of wild because the seats there were right on, literally, we were on the field. We were not on the field, but we were on the first row.
Wow.
Like looking out onto the field at the, what in Boston is famous as the pesky pole.
Oh, at the pesky pole. Wow.
Yeah. Literally, wow. I could reach out and touch it from where I was. I was sitting right next to it, which
is fun,
too. Did you
reach out and touch the pesky pole?
I did reach out and touch it at one point.
I mean, you would have to.
Yeah. There were people, we come up, we late innings, people come up with Sharpies and they just sign the whole thing. Like people write their names on it. It's a thing. And then they repaint it every year. So,
sure.
But it was also the night that they had a tribute for our late broadcaster, Jerry Remy,
yeah.
Who died last year. They brought out, they like, not only did they bring out all these like broadcasters who work with them, including Sean McDonough, who used to be his partner, who I knew growing up a little bit, like as one of the broadcasters. Joe Castiglione, my favorite, who's the radio guy and has been doing it basically as long as I've been alive. But a whole bunch of old players who had played with Remy when he played on the Red Sox,
right.
Including Carl Yastrzemski walked out there, and I was like, holy crap, I thought he was dead.
No, in fact, sorry for everybody out there for the baseball tangent.
Yeah,
Carl Yastrzemski was actually made an appearance there in 2019 when his grandson, plays for the Giants, came to town, and so Carl was there to make an appearance with his grandson, and then his grandson, Mike Yastrzemski, who plays for the Giants, hit a home run at Fenway Park, and it was one of those really kind of magical moments when Yastrzemski hit a home run at Fenway Park after all that time. They ask him about his grandpa every now and then. He's like, yeah, grandpa's fine. He doesn't go out a lot. He's getting up there, but he's you know, sharp-minded. And
I feel embarrassed to learn that he is... I just looked it up. I looked up his birthday. He is about... 4 months younger than my dad.
Than your dad, yeah, sure.
I was there, actually, a thing I remembered when he came out, I was there the day they retired his number.
Oh, wow.
At Fenway Park, which I'm looking up now, was August 1989. I was like, God, I was like 9 years old, but
anybody,
I was there.
Anybody who knows Dan knows that he wears a Red Sox hat, so this is your payment for that. You gotta get in some Red
indeed.
Sox stuff. Anyway,
Red Sox talk.
My disappointment, it's awesome that you saw the Jerry Remy tribute. My disappointment, of course, is that Don Orsillo, his longtime broadcast partner, actually was asked to record a thing because he's a Padre broadcaster now because Nesson fired him, and everybody was kind of angry about that. He's a Padres broadcaster. He's one of the greatest... TV broadcasters in baseball. He recorded a thing for Jerry Remy night and they didn't use it.
Oh wow, I didn't realize that.
My
friend who was there, who's an even bigger Red Sox fan than me, was like, oh yeah, Orsillo's in San Diego, so they couldn't get him probably.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that it was
he tweeted it out afterward. He was like, so I did record a thing, here's what I said, and he put the text of what he said up there because you know, he said that I guess his first year there was when Remy, I think, got his cancer diagnosis. So he said he saw him fight it for 13 years. Anyway, that's our baseball talk. It's about magic. It's about baseball. It's about technology a little bit. It's all in there.
Yeah, a little bit of everything.
I have a play date here.
Yes.
I was in the...
cranking it.
In group one. I was one of the first 111 customers to get one.
Wow, that's pretty good. You know what? I thought I ordered mine pretty quick, and yet... Oh, well. I'm in group two.
That's not you're they're shipping them now. This
they're
is
shipping,
a,
yeah.
this is a well, good sign.
It'll get there. It'll get here in a few
this
months.
This is a good sign. It's much this is from Panic, makers of great Mac software and publishers occasionally of games, and they made a handheld game system, which is such a weird idea. And I love that they did it. I also love that it took much longer than they thought, and it's only shipping now because they were showing these at WWDC in, again, 2019. It's shipping in small quantities. They're ramping up their shipping batches. It's adorable. Yeah, it's adorable. There's a lot of Panic attention to detail, I would say, and a lot of anybody who knows Cable Sasser from Panic, especially his deep abiding love for Nintendo and for chiptune music. Like you can tell that this is a product that is made out of love, and that they also wanted it to be quirky. So it's like not backlit, but it's a 1-bit display. It's just black and white, but super high refresh and high resolution. And it's got a little crank on the side that's a game mechanic. It's just a fun idea. I love that this exists, and I'm looking forward to getting, I guess once you activate it, you get 2 games a week for 8 weeks or something like that. And there are games you can download. There's a whole side loading thing, and they've built a whole this is one of the things that I really like about it. Talk about, I think the subtext here is how they view software versus perhaps like how Apple views software and other game and game console makers as well. They built a simulator. They built a development system. They built a separate development system that's like an easy development system that you just use the web. And then right, you can yeah. sideload games, or you can just go to their website and drag and drop a zip file of a game, and it will within a few hours sync to your device if you don't want to sideload it directly over USB. And so basically they're saying, yeah, make games. And all those development tools have been out there for, of course, a long time now because the product got delayed. Yep. So I just love that. They're like, yeah, make games for it. Have fun. We're not trying to control this thing. We'll ship our games for it, but we want people to just make games for it, which I think is just fun. I think it's fun that they're just open about it like that, and they want to create ways. You can write in C. You can write in Lua. You can use this the web app to build things. I love it. Great idea.
Yeah, I spent like 10-15 minutes with the web app at one point and was like, this is super cool. I don't have a game idea, so no. I'm not going to invest the time. I will say years and years ago, I got into making games a little bit in HyperCard. I made like a dungeon crawls in HyperCard because it was really good for that. And you learned like a very little bit of HyperTalk to do some of the, you know, scripting and whatever, put buttons in places and that kind of thing. And that was always fun. But that, you know, it was not like I made like a finished game that went anywhere. It was just messing around. And so I felt like looking at the tools, I'm like, man, the tools have come a long way, but I still don't have the impetus to actually sit down and make a game. But it's cool that they are making them so easy and available, like in terms of anybody who does have that desire to do so.
Yeah, my best thing that I've come up with is that I wish it had a baseball game on it, speaking of baseball, because I love the idea of like old style, whether it was an old style baseball arcade thing where you maybe use the crank to pitch or to hit or something like that, or even if it was like some of those old simulator games like I had for the Apple II, where you basically just choose like, you know, do you want to pitch, or do you want to throw the runner out, or do you want to guard the lines or stuff like that, and then you just see what happens and then you go on to the next batter. Like I would yep. love something like that on there, but again, I have no such skills. I also thought about like adventures, like text adventure or LucasArts style adventure, something right where it's like that would be fun stuff. I'm sure people are making everything for every genre for this thing.
A baseball game would be cool. I have fond memories of playing both on the NES right? and the Atari like old baseball games.
I think the way this works, I mean we'll see what happens with the play date in terms of software written for it, but it strikes me as being something that's sort of like modern indie game takes on classic nostalgic handheld video game genre titles from the past, right?
Like
that,
sure,
that feels like what they're doing, and I think that's a fun idea, right? It's like, we all remember this kind of game, now I'm gonna make my indie version of that game today, and that's a fun idea. It's adorable.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too, because it's got that they're like rolling stuff out kind of gradually, like game-wise, right? Like there's a season.
Yeah, so you get two games every week for like 8 weeks. So it comes with two games, basically. It syncs two games immediately, and that starts the clock. And then next week I'll get two more games, and then I'll get two more games the week after that. So, which I love that idea. I think having a season of little games that just drop onto the device is awesome. The storage is big enough that I don't think you'll ever fill it.
But it means that, like, if I get mine later, my season starts when I get it.
Yes, that's the idea.
So I don't get to like binge all the games that you have already.
They're
played.
They're not going to drop, you know, 20 games on there. They're going to make you wait, which is I think is fun.
Sure,
it's a fun little thing. I've got a little cover for it. It's purple over the yellow. It's adorable.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. It's just a fun little thing. I love it. This is actually, it's actually kind of like when I was talking about that thing that I got, the floppy Emu, that is the floppy drive emulator, and the blue SCSI, that are these things that you can attach to an old Mac and put an SD card in them, and they'll just run, they think there's a disk drive, but there isn't. It's right. It's a very similar thing where it's like our technology is such now that we that there's the ability for hardware to exist, whether it's something like the Playdate, which is built to be mass produced, you know, thousands and thousands of them, or something like the Floppy Emu or the Blue SCSI that are kind of hand built, and there's, you know, maybe hundreds of them. But it's like, you know, everything is so miniaturized and powerful now that you can have these full computers that are just, let's make a game thing, or let's make this emulator with a screen that's more powerful than the computer that it's attached to. But never mind.
Right,
that.
There's that one. Mike has that other one, right? The Pocket, right?
Oh, yeah. The one that is that's the, it's like a program.
It's like a Game Boy player.
Yeah, it'll play old handheld game cartridges. Yeah. Literally, you insert the cartridges and it'll play it.
Wild.
It's a modern bit of hardware, and it'll supports a bunch of different standards.
Very clever.
Yeah,
very clever,
right?
And strange. The idea of, like, speaking to someone, you know, so I have a PlayStation 5 that I've had for a few months now, and I got the one that doesn't have a disc drive because I'm like, I feel like acquiring more discs. I know it's cheaper and you can buy them secondhand and there is an advantage to that, but I really don't want more discs littering up my house. So the idea of like, oh, I'd have to go buy old cartridges,
yeah,
because I don't have a backlog of like handheld cartridge games.
And that's the legal issue. Although I think maybe you can put images on them and they work, but the way that it is a product,
right,
that is
sure.
legal is you can drop, it's the Analog Pocket.
Yeah.
And it's the size of a Game Boy, basically, but it's a piece of modern hardware, and it's got adapters for different things. So it's Game Gear, Neo Geo, Atari Lynx, like all of these little handheld things that they sell adapters for. If you've got really, I mean, the way they're pitching it is, if you've got old cartridges that you love, you can run it on modern hardware, and then it also does like MIDI or something. It's very weird, but it's yeah,
clever.
same thing. It's a fun idea.
I like it a lot. Yeah, can I? I want to know if I can put my old handspring visor.
Oh no, that would be like a modem card in there.
Yeah, that's what I want. No,
see what not. I did find my Palm 3 the other day. It's still floating around here somewhere.
Think I tossed my PDAs. I do have a DS, an original Nintendo DS, but I don't think this one works with that because that's like little like solid state cards, not cartridges.
Yeah, yeah. So I wrote not about baseball or games for once. I'll just throw this in there. I wrote a couple things this week. Had a weird week. Was reduced capacity for various family and logistical reasons, but I wrote my thing about Ecamm Live, which is my journey to deciding that I'm going to stream video using the app Live from Ecamm Network, which is a Mac only video streaming app that I really wanted to love in 2019 or whenever I tried it out, and it just didn't work.
Yeah,
we looked at it for Total Party Kill. I looked at it for Liftoff when we were going to do a live thing, and we used it for that. But even then, it was so frustrating about the limited control I had over what went where. And I wrote to them at the time, and I said, I want to use your product, but it seems so focused on, I think rightly so, focused on the specific needs of certain kinds of streamers. And I'm a control freak, or as my friend Randy likes to call it, control enthusiast. And I just want everything where I want it. I want to design. I want to have the whole control over the canvas. I want the background to look the way I want, the pictures, you know, the video boxes where I want. I don't want it to control it and say, well, this is a two up and this is a one up. And like, no, I will make them. And so I gave up, and then I came back 2 years later, and everything that I felt was missing from the app was there, which I guess says something too about the fact that this is maybe a sustainable business model for them, where it's a subscription-based
sure,
app.
Subscription, yeah,
so they keep
right.
improving it. But, you know, we end up with this app that if you ever do any live video production on the Mac, it is to YouTube or Twitch or anywhere else. It's so much more flexible now. Not that there aren't things that I wish that it did differently or better, because there's room for improvement. But
yep.
It has been a long time, I will tell you, since I looked at a product, found it lacking, went away, didn't pay attention to what was going on, came back and found that it was no longer lacking. It's a really
way
nice
better,
feeling.
Yeah, way better than like opening the same product week after week thinking, God, I wish they would fix this.
Right?
And they never do.
Or there's
right?
an update like, and you go back to it and you're like, no, it still doesn't. It's, you know, right? Because a lot of apps, they sort of like, the reason that they don't do what you want is because they have their worldview and that's just what it is. And they don't think what you want is what their product should be. And fair enough. But this was really great because I felt like this is a direction this product probably should grow in. And they did grow in it. And like I just think it makes it a much more relevant product for more people because now you can say it's still got, like you can see it, right? There's this source menu in Live. And by default, unless you change the default, the source menu is like your camera. Full
right.
screen. I'm like, that's not what that's not what I want. But you can now have the source be blank, and yep. then just do what you want. And it has all the tools to let you do what you want. And it just completely kind of transformed it for me. And on Apple Silicon, it really like it's using all the features and hardware and software that Apple has put in to do this stuff. And you can feel it. I mean, I think it's more. Easy to use and functional and smooth on Intel too, but on Apple Silicon you can really feel it.
So this, you know, you and I both were playing around this over the last couple of weeks, and I was running it on my 2017 iMac, which is not a like pokey machine. It's got a 4.2 i7 in it, so it's not like it's, you know, totally garbage. And it ran into some issues for me, and it was like cranking the fans and all that, which is to say any streaming software I've ever used on this Mac is intensive, right? Like streaming software in general feels like it's fairly like a high intensive piece of software, but in particular stuff that's not optimized to use the Mac hardware. And it was just not working for me. And I was like, all right, I'm going to have to stick with, as frustrated as I am with OBS, which is kind of the standard, I'm going to have to stick with that for the moment. And then we were talking about it and you ran a stream on it. And I was like, oh, it does seem like it maybe worked a lot better on your Apple Silicon. So yeah. I pulled out my Air, my M1 Air, and brought it up next to my iMac while I was, you know, playing, D&D on my iMac. I was running the stream off a separate device. And I'll tell you, it ran like butter
yeah.
on an M1 just fine. Mm-hmm. And the only downside was, honestly, even this, at one point I clicked on the, you know, when you have the battery icon, because I didn't have it plugged in because I didn't have a convenient plug nearby. And I clicked on the battery icon, so it tells you like apps using significant energy, and it was Zoom. It didn't list Ecamm
wow.
Live. But I was like, so it's not even Ecamm Live that's
wow.
running down my battery here so much as the Zoom call that I'm capturing.
Oh, man, that is that's
yeah, which
amazing.
I thought was great. And so I laughed at that, and I had to scramble and find a plug. But it worked great. I used it on our weekly TPK game that we do on Tuesday nights. And
looked
it worked.
Good.
It worked fabulous for that. And I got to say, like, it does have a lot of niceties. Like, I've had to readjust my workflow a little bit just to, because I was very used to doing stuff in a particular way. And I realized, oh, there's all these things I'm doing that are like workarounds, basically.
Right. That you
to
don't
get
need
this to
do.
Work. And I was like, oh, this is so much easier. Although having it on a second computer is a little ridiculous and frustrating. And that's where I come back to, like, as soon as I get an Apple Silicon desktop,
yeah, yeah.
I will definitely be doing it on there. But I was also similarly impressed with the improvements that have been made. Like you, I have some. You know, I have some nitpicks. I have some thoughts about like little tweaks that could be made. But overall, it is just a performance-wise, if nothing else. And the fact that it is a native Mac app
right.
and not an open source app that has been adapted makes
interface-wise, too. Like you could tell it's not an open source cross-platform
yep.
app. It's a
yep.
Mac app. It's a kind of the exception that proves the rule, I would say, when people, but still, when people say there aren't any Mac-assed Mac apps, is I think the way that somebody yeah. phrased it, like that it's just like a super Mac designed for Mac. Like, well, here it is. It came live. Yeah. It's about 5 years old, but like it's a new, growing Mac-only, dedicated, pro, basically, app. And it's really good. So I wanted to love it. And now I do.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to using it more because it does feel like now that I've got something that's a little more stable. I mean, to me, the performance thing is the big thing because the problem that I had, and I probably have if not talked about this before here, I've talked about it in other places probably, OBS has some problems when it comes to capturing Windows on the Mac.
Oh, it does.
Fundamentally, the window capture interface is broken. And in fact,
and we know
there is a fix. There is a fix for it from Apple that they have yet to roll out, at least as of my last check, that was supposed to improve performance.
Because they're doing it wrong, essentially, in terms of how you're supposed to do it on the Mac platform. And it's not
and
surprising.
The frame rate
that
is terrible.
Yeah, it's not surprising that an open source project that is primarily used on Windows would not focus on these areas. Yeah. But it is one of those cases. It's actually, I would say it's very similar to when Safari started, which is your platform is being judged badly, not because of your platform, but because of the software on it doing bad things. And that was Internet Explorer back in the day, and that's why they did Safari, was that Mac was bad at the internet.
And that was so critical at that point, too, right?
Yeah, like web literally people were saying, you don't want to buy a Mac because it's bad. Its web browser is bad. And Apple's like, well, but that's because of Microsoft. So they're like, well, we need to write our own web browser and have it be fast.
No one cares, right? Nobody's going to respect you if you're like, it's their fault, not our fault.
Yeah,
because
it's a fundamental thing about your platform that's bad and you don't control it, which is, I think, one of the roots of Steve Jobs' whole philosophy of like, we need to control the things that are important to
bring
us.
Stuff in-house.
So this is like that, too, where it's like, okay, so they're not doing it, but it's like, it makes it, everybody's like, oh, Mac's really bad for OBS. And like, I have multiple friends who bought PCs just for OBS because the Mac is so bad at it. And then here comes somebody from Apple on a GitHub account that's basically an Apple GitHub account saying, you're doing it wrong. Here's a code fix that fixes this thing so window capture works right. And it's just like, wow.
We'll get to it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was that and a combination of the fact that you sit around thinking, like, I know. Like, Apple has built-in stuff, correct me if I'm wrong, like coprocessor stuff that is optimized for encoding video, and it doesn't use any of it.
You see this with Handbrake, too, if you're encoding videos. Yeah. It's like Handbrake, again, a cross-platform tool, and it was Apple's got all of these coprocessors. They had them on the T2. They have them in Apple Silicon. They have Video Toolbox, I think, is one of them, where it's like a locked-in hardware encode that is super fast. And a lot of these tools are like, we're just going to use the standard one.
Again, they don't know how to adapt it to the platform, right?
Or they're not
specific tools are like, well, we have to tune, we have to change the code so it uses different APIs. Right. And we don't have the time or inclination to learn about it, or we don't have the hardware.
And everybody
and
else
just not
is just
gonna bother.
Using Windows using a graphics card, so we'll just do it that way.
Right.
And
exactly.
The Mac's architecture is different and is becoming more different. The T2 made it different. Now, Apple Silicon makes it even more different.
Right.
And I actually kind of like the idea. I don't know if they're going to do more of this, but I actually kind of like the idea of Apple taking some of its resources in key areas and saying, we're going to look at apps that people are using that are cross-platform and open source that don't work right on the Mac, and we're going to have some of our people fix them so they work right on the Mac. Like, it is an extension of Apple's sort of approach to open source projects, but it's reaching outward, right? It's saying, hey, Handbrake, or in this case, hey, OBS, here's a fix. Now, it's frustrating that fix hasn't been actually brought into the main trunk of the app yet, apparently. But like, I love that idea, right? That Apple would say,
100%.
You're doing it wrong. Let us help, because we want the Mac version of this to be awesome and show off. I mean, at this point, it would be and show off how awesome Apple Silicon is, right? That they want to do that. And maybe some of that is happening behind the scenes. But with open source projects, you know, they can't go to the developer as easily as they could go to a commercial software developer. They go to Adobe and say, here's how you do this in Premiere. I'm sure they did that. You know, when they were starting the work on Apple Silicon, they were talking to Adobe about it. But for open source project, it's trickier.
Yeah, but it's. I agree with you. I think that is it does a lot of good for the company. It does a lot of good for its users. I think it's all on the upside. Like, and I would love to see more of that, because there is a huge slew of tools that are available that run on macOS. They're just not good. On macOS.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying, hey, you want extra bonus points, you send somebody in to like, oh, we've also, you know, when the Mac version actually now has a better like UI on it too. But that's that would be frosting on the cake.
Right. But like platform support, platform features that are apparently not, you know, people aren't aware of. Like the OBS thing, it really was like, you guys don't seem to be aware that we have this way to do this that is the right way. And so they implemented that. And it's like, well, geez, yeah, that I have. Why, I have noticed that window capture in OBS on macOS is terrible. Not on Live, by the way. Huh.
Yeah. It
Funny.
Was, again, like I said, running even on an M1, you know, the base level Apple Silicon chip.
MacBook Air.
A MacBook Air. It was smooth.
Smooth
it
as
was,
butter. Yeah.
Yeah. I was blown away with it. It was it night and day. And it was, it also, because I told you we had all these workarounds, right? And we were talking about this where it's like, oh, well, in order to get a slightly better version of performance on OBS, you would, instead of doing a window capture, you do a display capture after the whole screen, and you'd crop it down to just the section you wanted.
And don't
even
accidentally
not,
move a window over the
don't
over
move a window
area.
Over it. And so now you're on UCam, and we're like, oh, it can actually like capture that window correctly, and I don't have to worry about like what other windows are in the... Wow, that... Boy,
it's a revelation, right?
Yeah, it really. So kudos to the Ecamm guys who have made many great tools over the years, including the Skype call recorder that we used for so many years.
Right. They did the print thing that let you air print.
Printopia.
Yeah, yep. Printopia, yep. Right.
They had eyeglasses for like tweaking your webcam setting and stuff like that. They've made a lot of great tools. Exactly. They are one of the great examples of Mac developers making stuff that is stuff that Apple should have made or other companies should have built into their software. And they find those little niches and they're just like, yep, we're just going to build a thing that does this. And it is just so valuable when they do it that I never have any hesitation of being like, here's my money. You've done a great job.
So never let it be said that there aren't at least some developers making great new Mac apps, because Live is that. Very quickly, yesterday I wrote a thing just basically keying off of something I heard in Accidental Tech Podcast about Marco Arment talking about how he loves the big HomePod and how frustrated he is that there's no real equivalent to it. And I thought, where have I heard that before? It's like when we talked about the Studio Display, and they're not quite the same because the HomePod was a market failure and the Studio Display seems to be a success in that they're way back ordered. But they are similar in the sense that there's a big market full of products in this category. But when you boil it down, this one particular product is, in typical Apple fashion, over-engineered, it's overpriced, it's doing way more than what most people want. And that is true of the Studio Display, too, which explains all those reviews that were like, oh, you should just buy a cheaper, you know, a 32-inch 4K Dell display and be happy. It's like, well, no. I want this very particular set of specs, if you do. And Marco's comments about the HomePod reminded me of that too, which is, as much as the reviews of the HomePod were, wow, it seems over-engineered and it's very expensive for a single mono speaker, that's true. It is also true that if the HomePod is exactly what you want, there's no alternative, in part because people don't buy it. It's a very not very popular product. But I was just reminded of that sometimes that's what happens, is you get a product that you love. And it's great, and it fits in your life, but they didn't sell enough of them, and they just stopped making it. And, like I said in the article, my dad's favorite chip was discontinued in the early 80s, late 70s, and it was just like, there's nothing you can do. I really like that chip. Well, yeah, but not enough people did, so you can never have it again.
I don't think they really make any more.
Prontos, by the way, they Sun chips are my dad's favorite chip. From the 70s.
Favorite.
They rebranded it like 10, 15 years later. And I like Sun chips. I guess I get that from
Product 19 was a Kellogg's cereal that I loved growing up. And it was discontinued in 2016.
See?
So sad.
So that's what I feel about Marco's thing. It just struck me that like, he's right. The HomePod was expensive, but it was also engineered for lots of reasons to be like a really high quality, and it does the computational thing in terms of your room, and like it has a lot going for it. That it's not a fundamentally bad product. It's a we often, I think, to our detriment, mix up market success with the quality of the product. And like the HomePod is good at what it's good at. It's
also
a market
bad at
miss.
Some things, to be clear.
Well, I mean, it's
Siri
and it doesn't have
really
an aux
bad.
In, and I've got criticisms about it that are about the product itself. But the real that's separate from the fact that it's kind of a bad market fit. Like they came into the smart speaker market with a really expensive thing that didn't really get uptake. It doesn't necessarily that part of it. like doesn't change the fact that, you know, Marco is going to be buying these and that they're going for more than they originally sold for on eBay, right?
I laughed at that because I have two here in my office and I thought to myself,
it's like gold, man,
do I need some money? Yeah, so I use this as a jumping off point for my MacWorld article for next week, which is talking about how in my opinion, Apple shouldn't be afraid to get weird and do kind of strange products that don't feel like they fit in, because you never know, right? Like, I think the sort of root of that argument is like, you look back at some of the other products they've made in history, the original Mac comes to mind, or the original iPod. These are kind of weird diversions for them where you think, why is Apple making a music player, right? Don't they make PCs? Mm-hmm. And it ends up being a huge hit. You never know, right? A lot of them are going to be misses and they won't find their niche. But I think taking risks is a big part of what has made Apple successful. And sometimes those things pay off. So I'm sort of thinking about some of the other products that we've been rumored to hear about that don't fit nicely in there. Like, you can look at a lot of the products that Apple makes now and think it's kind of predictable, right? Like, okay, Apple, you know, Macs based on Apple Silicon. We kind of knew that was coming. iPhones and iPads, you know, they're all really well established, right? They can make a lot of money out of revising them every couple of years and sort of pushing it forward very slowly. But every once in a while, then you get, they're like, oh, we're doing a smartwatch, right? And you're like, okay. Tell me more. Like, why do you think this is a thing worth pursuing? And so there are some rumors of stuff out there that I'm interested in. The successor to the HomePod that Mark Grimmon keeps talking about, with a camera and a set-top box built in or whatever. I'm like, that sounds weird. I don't know. Would that be a success? Are people going to replace their set-top box with this thing? No idea. It doesn't seem like it, but who knows? Maybe it's really great and everyone will. Or even I would class into that the augmented reality VR stuff that they're working on. I have no idea why Apple thinks that's a product it would be good at, other than it has the hardware and software to make one.
Yeah.
But I don't know what it's for, and that is wild to me. And I'm excited about that because it makes me believe they must have an idea of what it's for, because if they're investing all this time and money,
you would hope
they want to sell them. And if they want to sell them, they must have an idea of how to market them to people. I don't know what that is, but I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I think Apple, as much as I think Apple's conservatism in choosing what products to release has benefited it overall, it has also sometimes those bets are not, it's the bet you don't make that hurts you, right? And the one that I always bring up is Samsung. We laugh at Samsung for releasing products willy-nilly and trying to find the hits, and then the rest of them they just kill, and Apple doesn't want to do that. But that's the reason Samsung realized there was a huge appetite for larger phones, and Apple was behind the curve on that by several years because of it. I'm not suggesting that Apple throw a bunch of stuff against the wall, but I do think to say that Apple is going to get heavily mocked and criticized for any product of its that flops, like the HomePod. But so what? Like, you know, don't let it hurt your feelings. You're an incredibly powerful company.
Yeah, exactly.
The goal is to make products that are good. And that goes back to the HomePod, right? Like, make a product you're proud of. And if it doesn't find a market fit, so be it. But make a product that you're proud of. Now, I would argue that the problem with the HomePod is that they overshot. And the HomePod Mini is an interesting example of them scaling way back and saying, well, why don't we start down here? And I would not be surprised if the HomePod Mini now gains features over time and they kind of creep upward.
Sure.
But like, they overshot in terms of broad popularity, but at least they were proud of it, right? There was like, but look at all the technology we put in. It's like, yes, you did. That is absolutely true.
Nobody asked for it.
Yeah. So don't make a bad, I'm not saying make bad products and spew them out there and see what happens, but I am, and you should try to calibrate and have it be a success. But yeah, if it's a little weird, that's okay.
Yeah, and when you're the most valuable company in the world,
you can afford
you can afford to try it, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Again, I agree with you.
You don't want to miss it.
Don't throw everything against the wall. But like, when you have a good idea, don't be afraid to put some resources behind it, even if it may not end up being that thing. Because you end up, like I said, the original Mac or the Apple Watch or the iPod, like, you have no idea what's going to be a hit, what might capture people's ideas. I don't think even Apple expected the iPod to achieve the success it did, right? Like,
no.
They're like, it's a music player.
Yeah.
It's cool. Like, it's super innovative. But like, its response was, I think maybe with the iPhone, they had a better idea of what they had on their hands. But the iPod to me was just sort of like a...
No, Steve Jobs loved music and was into the MP3 thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a
And then somebody at Apple saw that new Toshiba hard drive and they're like, I wonder if we could do portable, you know, portable music player. and but, it all just sort of happened. You know, but you're right. It was a shot in the dark that worked.
For every one of those, you've got things that seem like products that seem carefully engineered to hit certain categories and are arguably kind of uninspiring.
Yeah.
I'll throw the Apple TV in that mix, which is, it does its job. Is it a great product? It's not really a great product, but it takes all the boxes. You know, it's maybe a little overpriced, but there's nothing exciting about it as a project.
Having seen the competition, I think it's better than the competition, but it's not like transforming.
It's not a feel, right? It's not a feel that needed to have. You could argue that it's over-engineered as well, too, right?
Yeah.
With all the stuff focused on game playing and stuff like that. It's like, most people don't want that. That's why most people are fine with the apps built into their TVs.
Right.
Like, it's fine. It's a good. I agree. The UI is good. It has a lot of great stuff on it. I'm very happy with the one I have. The one I have is also many years old because I don't have, famously, a 4K TV, so I haven't needed to update
it. It's old. 1080 Dan.
That's me.
The Amazon Echo is the one that I keep thinking of because Apple had Siri. And Apple had its music connections, and Apple totally could have made that product. But when the Echo came out, it was like, what? This is so weird. And you got one, and you're like, actually, it's kind of cool. And I have had one in my kitchen ever since, gone through different iterations. And, like, Apple could have done that, but they, you know, and I know that there's an argument that Apple needs to focus on, you know, the most important products. And I get that. But also, Apple is a very large company with a lot of money, and they could build out a broader set of groups that could make products like this. And they haven't done that. And maybe that's a secret to their success, and fair enough. But it is one of those things where Apple could have made an Amazon Echo and beaten Amazon to the punch, but it didn't. Like it had the stuff, and it just missed its shot.
Together.
And then when it did the HomePod, it didn't find it. And only now with the HomePod Mini, which I get the impression is doing better, but I don't think it's sweeping Google Homes and Amazon Echoes off of people's shelves. So
at least you put your stake down.
Yeah. Well, okay. So that was the week that was, and it's over now.
On to the next one.
To the next one. WWDC is
lurking
6 weeks
away. Over the horizon.
It's coming. It's coming.
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, thanks to everybody out there for being a member of Six Colors and for listening to this podcast. We'll see you next week. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.